Hi everyone, welcome back to the Lake Podcast. I'm your host, Karthik Nachipan. Before I begin, I want to mention that this is Lake's 25th episode. When I started this podcast, I did not think or expect to continue the podcast for how many ever episodes. I was hoping there would be enough people out there interested in books about South Asia, and it looks like there is. I'm surprised by how many of you tune in to listen to these episodes, and for that I'm deeply grateful. I'm also very grateful to all the authors who have joined me to speak about their books so far. So now, on to the 25th episode. In developing countries, there's a lot we know about how policies are crafted, the various factors and considerations that justify the formulation of a policy or a specific program, especially those related to mass welfare. We, however, know relatively little about how these policies are implemented on the ground. Do they face challenges? How much political will is required? Do local elites support policy implementation? How do bureaucrats deal with potential resistance? In a fascinating new book, Georgetown sociologist Rajesh Veeraraghavan addresses these questions by investigating the implementation of India's National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, a massive centralized public program that guarantees adults from rural households the right to work for 100 days doing manual labor on rural development projects. Resistance and challenges do exist, as Veeraraghavan argues, but they can occasionally be surmounted by digital technologies that could improve policy implementation, benefiting marginalized citizens and communities. Veeraraghavan conceptualizes this process as patching, akin to patching in software development, to resolve last-mile challenges that generally dog bureaucrats when it comes to implementing policies. These patches allow officials to exercise more control and power by using various digital technologies and related institutional fixes to ensure policies are not stymied by local elites, political parties, and lower-level bureaucrats. Though patching may be a technical fix, it does represent a form of politics, a political process through which certain individuals, bureaucrats, exercise power over others to foster specific outcomes. It need not always be good outcomes. Patching could, when used for other purposes, degenerate, producing harmful outcomes. But in this book, the focus is on generating positive pro-poor development outcomes that emanate out of a series of technical and institutional fixes, or patches. Here is Rajesh Veeraraghavan on patching development, information politics and social change in India, recently published by Oxford University Press. Rajesh, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really excited to talk to you about the book. But before we get to the book, I'm hoping you can share with us your journey to academia. So before your PhD, you were at Microsoft Research India, and then an engineer before that. So, and I presume all of these experiences influenced the book from what I gather. And I want to understand that better. So talk to us about that transition from Microsoft to Berkeley, and then now to this book.
Thank you, Karthik, for having me on. I think it's hard to, if you look at somebody's CV like mine, it's hard to kind of not ask this question. It's like, what the hell are you doing here? It's definitely a nonlinear path and something that I did not expect that I would be an academic. And so I guess I did the done thing. I guess wanted to be a software person. And I mean, but the way even I got there was through economics. And again, that was an accident. And I wanted to make a lot of money. I wanted to go to investment banking and spend some time in Bombay and in the financial services. And then I came to the US and did economics and then computer science. I thought combining the my training in economics and computer science systems was the most highest paid job that there was. And I thought, some friends were in the Wall Street. So I thought that was the direction, very going gung-ho on it. But then I think I was introduced to a group, a volunteering group called AID, Association for India's Development, which was very popular and still is in the US campuses, which essentially started by volunteers from Maryland College Park and spread to multiple chapters. I started the chapter. I was there at Clemson, South Carolina, which was basically trying to kind of both sensitize people, us, I mean, like who are volunteers, about some of these issues, socioeconomic development issues that were happening, as well as raise money for funding projects, right? We had Sangharsh Nirman was the slogan, activism and development, right? And both together. And that was kind of seeped into my work. Largely, I think if you read my thing, I have projects which are both quote unquote constructive. I mean, I guess you can be constructive by resisting, but also, but you know what I mean? Like at least that there's some kind of an analytic separation for people wanting to build things and people want to, oppose things like, the Dharmada Dam, for example, right? You have Medha Patkar coming in and talking to us and sensitizing us. And so that was just something that was parallelly happening. And meanwhile, my professional job, software, started writing code. So I guess the first move was to move away from Wall Street and go to, nothing wrong with my Wall Street friends, but from that to, writing code. And then I was parallelly getting politicized and sensitized with the questions of development. So, through the process, I basically became familiar with a lot of NGOs and activists in India who were working on various things. And I felt like my first education was before my PhD, actually, because, we would aggressively host people who would want to come to who would come to the US and learn from them and spend an insane amount of time with them, cooking for them, and driving them to the airports and whatnot, attending talks and organizing, raising money. So that's my first education, actually, PhD, before my PhD, in terms of these issues from people who are actually on the ground. And then, obviously, I think then, I think long story short, so just immediately end up, somehow, I don't know, I think we can track if you want how that PhD process happened. So I ended up, I guess trying to combine these two interests, right? MSR was starting a lab in India, I think, at the time. So I started probably the first or second hire, looking at technology for, they call it emerging markets, because, it's a company. So, so then I somehow thought everybody around me had a PhD, so I should get a PhD. It was nothing really deep. By the time I had kind of had some familiarity with research. So that's how I kind of, then I went to Berkeley and landed up in this fantastic place, which allowed people who have kind of crazy backgrounds like mine fit in well and supported my journey. And I trained myself in sociology there. And some of my advisors was, sociologists. So that's how the kind of, the precursor, so to speak, the book and the interests in the book was formed, was before I even, got there.
Before I get to the book, I want to ask you a larger question first. And I think this connects to the heart of what the book is trying to do and what it argues. How would you describe the Indian state? Is it pathological? is it flailing? Is it inconsistent? It does certain things well, like elections. It does other things really badly, like providing healthcare. What is your judgment here? I mean, how would you describe it?
I guess the first question that I've learned to ask and hopefully also tease out in the book is what do you mean by the state, right? And all those things are true, right? Depending upon what you define the state is, and which state it is, and which part of India you're from, or which. So I would first disaggregate the state from a developmental state to a police state, right? And you know, I document in the book, and as well as others have, how, you know, there's this idea of flailing state, right? Pritchard has. It's an, you know, interesting proposition. But when I went to rural Andhra, and I actually, this is something I learned from another friend of mine, Vivek Srinivasan, who'd done this in Tamil Nadu, where he prompted me to kind of go look at police stations and records there. So I looked at the police stations and spent some time, you know, just writing down what they have about the village. They actually, this is from colonial times, right? They've tracked, like, they know exactly what's going on in the kind of the criminal side of things, right? Or the law and order kind of things. Who is the, you know, who is the biggest landlord? What are the protests that are happening? Who are the kind of problem characters, or, you know, and they use much more colorful language than that in their transcripts. And of course, the quality of that, you know, deteriorates over time. But in some sense, you could say, is it a flailing state? No, it's not in that sense, right? Because the state, this is, you know, and of course, one have to look at other, you know, states and see how much of it is true. But my sense is, you know, the police is present and keep, you know, records, very careful records of who's need to be protected, you know, who are the problem characters, what have been the kind of disturbances, you know, in the village, what are the factions that exist and the names, and, you know, you can kind of, there's a project that to be mined, right? So if you look at that, the state's pretty strong, it's very present, and they can, I mean, the people have written histories of how the state, even in Andhra, right, have systematically kind of gone in the past, you know, gone after, say, the Maoists, or and tracked people down and whatnot, right? So, but the other hand, you know, the reason I went there was to kind of see whether they actually have a sense of what's happening in quote unquote development projects, but you don't really see like how many, you know, whether Dalits go to school or whether, you know, there's water, and that is not even recorded, obviously, in the police station that was handled separately, right? And of course, different states have different capacities or different, you know, and so there is some truth to the fact that there is underinvestment of the state, and Stuart Corbridge, you know, nicely points out that this is contrary to Jim Scott's view of seeing like the state here, you know, that he says through development programs are the first attempts through which the state sees the poor sees the state, right? So in some sense, you know, these programs could be maybe an anti-politics machine, as Ferguson talks about in some parts of the world, but it's also a mechanism for which the poor actually can see parts of the state. And so, sorry to give you a complicated answer, but I'm just saying that it really depends on where you are and what aspect of the state you see, whether you want to see, you know, the state, in many respects, if you take Pritchett's view, the IAS offices in Delhi, and that's very strong. And there's a lot of consensus. We can have elections, we have budgets, you know, it's very strong capacity, you know, that'd be hard to kind of argue. But there is definitely underinvestment in schools. And but there are good things going on, midday meals, you know, Jean Dres talks about it being an amazing investment. in certain aspects of the state. So it's much more complicated as you would think. In India, you can get away with basically saying, you know, you can look at one arm of the elephant and say that's true. So the state is like that. It's very complicated.
Yeah, one of the reasons I asked that was because you actually get to see how the state operates through the book, because you focus on different levels, the upper level, the higher level, and how the state works, not just internally, but also with other actors outside the state. So the book actually focuses on how the Indian state delivers social benefits, right, to citizens. And you focus on the NREGA program in Andhra Pradesh. So how can states avoid those pesky last mile implementation problems, right, without being captured or thwarted by local power structures? Can you lay out why this last mile problem is so acute, particularly in the Indian context? What is it about the Indian state that lacks capacity here?
Yeah, so I think you know, just to kind of go back a little bit, right? When I was taking classes at Berkeley and look even through aid work, there's a lot of focus on why things fail, right? There's enough written about it. And my advisor, one of my advisors, Peter Evans, was kind of always looking for like how things change, right? And so there's thing, you know, I was kind of always looking for, he kind of pushed me and nudged me to say, you know, let's look at like, you know, we know that there's, you know, enough written about the failures and stuff, right? So let's look at like things that we can identify as positive or you know, at least points to something positive. So there's a lot of literature, a lot of work on how do you get the state, how do you get the political will of the state to see the poor, or how do you design, or economists, development economists were focused on how do you design programs that would, would work, right? Whether it's bed nets or whether it's, having, you know, women at leaders at the local level, should it be self-targeted? Should you kind of have mechanisms that would, whether it's to use technology, biometrics, or other, lots of focus on kind of how do you get the, you know, political scientists are interested in how do you get the politics right, or how do you get the political will for the state to see the poor and whatnot, or social movements, sociologists would be interested in it, or how do you kind of design programs and measure the impact, and less about looking at how once you actually have the political will and the design right, what happens, you know, at the implementation level. It's almost taken for granted. And I think it is still taken for granted. Oh, it's just institutions. It's you can get it. You can figure this out. And I wanted to kind of tell a story of how hard it is that what we usually think of corruption or simply dismiss as corruption actually is about power. There are people's interests are involved, and people resist these programs. And I wanted to kind of, I guess being a software programmer, if you've written a single piece of code, you know, you got to constantly maintain it. You have to constantly fix things. There are bugs and whatnot. So I realized that in this context, this debates about, you know, the getting the best design or as Peter Evans called it, you know, moving beyond institutional monocropping. You know, where you get the big shift was, well, we get the local context right, get the designs right for the institution, and then you're done. But I'm arguing, no, it's, you know, if you actually look at what people are actually doing, they are changing processes of governance practices all the time. So it has implications in both in terms of how you evaluate these programs or how you imagine it. So it's not just you have a kind of a one-time discussion about, oh, I somehow like, you know, understand the context, send people there and then figure this out. Because I think what it assumes is a naivete, assumes that people on the other hand, with local power structures are waiting around and not doing anything to your imaginations, right? And so people actually resist, and I document how it's obviously a very messy political process, and it's about power, who has exercising power. And so we, you know, it's, so I want to kind of move beyond this static debates about decentralization, centralization, you know, like all of these things, which assumes a very static mind, a static kind of formulation. And so I've kind of tried to, you know, both empirically describe what happened and not to celebrate like the Andhra model per se, or not to defend it, but characterize it accurately to the best I can, but also kind of open up different process, different structures. If patching development is something that I'm offering as a way, it's not so much what Andhra exactly did in the configurations of how they set it up, right? But it's kind of allow for shifting this broader discourse about, you know, how development happens in practice at the last mile, because there are powerful actors, you know, in this case, landed class, caste problems, gender, which I, you know, got a little bit into, but I didn't empirically discuss it, but not analytically. But there's a lot of like, you know, attention to, you know, power at the last mile that needs to be there. It's not that, I mean, of course, the first mile, as you, if you read the book, you have the first mile problems, if you will, of those bites back, right? I mean, like in the sense that it's not so much that all problems are the local at the last mile, like 100 days was kind of cop out or compromise at the first mile, like whether they take actions on these audit reports that I talk about, that depends on how much, where the society is, where the, who's got power and why, and how are they, you know, not opening up work beyond, you know, beyond certain times, all those kind of things that people, you know, a lot of scholarships have gone in, is important. But I wanted to kind of separate out that from the actual details of implementation. I want to, you know, not say, not, this shouldn't be a news for bureaucrats who actually, like if you look at any program, they issue circulars after circulars, and this is how it's done. So, but it's, I think, underappreciated in the theorization and the, you know, the, at least the academic discourse about it.
And that gets us to the central argument of the book. That's key to addressing this last mile problem, patching, a term that you borrow from software development, where patching is done to fix specific problems. So it's a top-down, fine-grained, iterative act that looks to manage and align interests and drive cooperation between different social groups and bureaucrats. I hope you can explain how you theorize patching, but also importantly, is there something about the policy context, whether that's Andhra Pradesh, whether that's NREGA, that makes it hospitable or amenable to patching? In other words, are there certain political contexts, power structures that are either decentralized, as you mentioned, or polycentric, where patching is more conducive than where it isn't?
Yeah, no, so it's a good question. So let me first take this idea of where I got this patching from. I mean, of course, I knew about patching. I've done enough patches in my life early on as a software developer. But actually, I was sitting in an office in Hyderabad, and there was some discussion about how to fix a particular attendance register to make it read-only, because they wanted to kind of allow or disallow modifications of it on the field, because they want to control who joins what group, and they want to freeze a worker group because they were worried that, you know, low-level bureaucrats were changing workers randomly and basically giving, in this case, they were, say, you know, making people, fabricating names and duplicating them. And so one solution that time was to, okay, let's not allow for that and not allow for that field to change and release the software patch. So I understood, I mean, I understood the fact that they were making these changes. I didn't really understand the broader significance, because I was kind of waiting to kind of have this big interview with this bureaucrat, like, you know, waiting for hours to kind of get my turn. Meanwhile, I was kind of getting a little irritated about, why are you worrying about all these small details and like the databases? He was kind of geeking out some of that details. And I missed the significance of it. I was there. I think I had some questions that I thought was more important at the time about politics, and the, you know, like which, you know, which village is captured, which, you know, which is, you know, which have their more resources and how is caste placed and all of that kind of big important things. And I realize over time that this is the bureaucrats do not have the capacity to kind of fundamentally change a lot of things on the ground. They can't kind of challenge local elites directly, right? I mean, it's like they couldn't increase the number of days, for example, but they could do things like this, which is fixing very small things. They started thinking about how do you get work opened in Dalit lands, because NREGA was a public project. They wanted to kind of make a small change, big change, but the small sounds like a small change, where they said, we want to allow only work to be done other than the public lands, also in Dalit lands, and they wanted to enforce it, right? So they started thinking about how do you do this. It's a very radical program. In fact, if one bureaucrat said, this is like not happened to actually allow like upper caste people to work on Dalit lands. But they were thinking through these details and implementing it through like changes in software, changes in processes, which were looked pretty like detail oriented, right? They would restrict they would do a geocode of the location of the Dalit land and say that this work would need to be in a land we approve and you know, all these kind of very small details. And they were thinking about it. And of course, everything they do would need to change because there would be resistance to these effects, right? Whether to read only might, for example, the geocoding was done wrong, they would go and, you know, how do you ensure that the geocoding was done properly, and how do you ensure attendance is registered correctly? So they would, you know, I mean, we can talk through the details of it, but the point to understand is that these kind of small changes, which I call patches, and it's not just technology, it's through other, to all other processes, non-tech processes, had to be, was done. And it's not an incremental, people have written about incremental policies, right? Like in the US context, for example, if you want to pass a healthcare, if you want to, let's say you believe in, universal healthcare, and you realize that passing universal healthcare is important, but we can't get there, we want to change, can do step one, step, maybe Medicare, Medicaid, and then eventually get there, right? That's different than what I'm talking about. Here, it's about implementation, right? You learn about things as you do it, and you change your plans in order to kind of deal with the resistance. And sometimes these quote-unquote simple processes that I'm talking about is very radical. It's not easy, right? The fix I talked about, getting people to work on, Dalit lands, is a very big thing. But it's not incremental in that sense, but it's a patch because it's not a one-time fix, as you said. So there's a lot of that kind of patching going on, and that's how I feel like the bureaucracies is trying to implement this program and to deal with local power. And then your question about where does patching apply and doesn't work. So I think patching is not a normative concept, right? Meaning patching is it's not necessarily good in that sense or bad, right? It's a certain, even in this book, I point out patching actually leads to chaos. Patching leads to this idea of solutionism, where, sometimes it does, it's analytically different from solutionism. Solutionism is the idea that, that it tries to solve problems that it can solve and leave the political problems out, right? So, you render problems technical. And so that leads to kind of like really not fixing real issues, but kind of fixing stuff that could be fixed. So there is a danger that, and have pointed out that, patching could also lead or degenerate into solutionism. The one example I started giving again, in a different context about patching could how to be bad, is the Georgia elect, in the state of Georgia in the US, there was a law that was passed to focus on banning water bottles for people standing in elections. And I was like, why is that like being issued? And that's because they wanted a lot of, they wanted to dissuade poor people who would, you know, would not benefit from standing in line, would like some water. And if you actually change that, you know, law or policy by having this very small change, it could lead to, you know, in this case, worse outcomes for the poor, right? So, and even in Andhra cases, a lot of, you know, patches, there was, in the work, the freezing the work groups thing itself was a patch, one could argue, with, at some points in time led to bad things because the workers wanted to be more fungible in terms of where they want to go work, because in on-demand work, it's right. But this restriction of where they should work and which work group led to, in certain villages, they did not want to work with certain people who was assigned part of the work group because they were actually, they had problems with them. And so they would, they don't want to be in the work, in the same work site for months they, because the conflict increases. And so they tried to change it to a different work group, but then the, you know, lower level bureaucrat said, well, you know, you're not, we can't change you because it's a patch already there. You're stuck to this, right? So my point is, I guess the larger point is, there's no real patching in itself is not necessarily a good thing, right? Patching just describes the, you know, a certain way of dealing with power. In this, you know, case, I'm just describing, you know, there's a, there is a particular context where, you know, the attempt by these bureaucrats at the top and auditors to kind of try and deal with local problems by taking power away or trying to deal with a power situation, in this case, happened to have, you know, arguably, you know, in general, a positive effect because of the kind of political configurations at the top. So, but it could easily lead to a, you know, a situation where it could lead to you know, worse outcomes. And even in this case, with such political will, such very good, you know, bureaucrats who were, you know, who saw power very differently, who, you know, who were Ambedkarians, who, you know, identify as Dalits, who saw villages in a different light and wanted to take power away. Even those things, they led, it led to kind of problems, right? And so, yeah, it's more yeah, it is context dependent, but it's also, even within the context, it's not exactly clear. It's not always will result in like outcomes that would you know, lead to something that you would agree with.
Yeah, I mean, I was just trying to understand, are there specific conditions, whether that's bureaucratic leadership or it's, you know, like in Andhra where they spent more money on these programs, or whether there's any other variable that affects the efficacy of a patching mechanism, right? I mean, that's what I was trying to understand.
Oh, yeah. So,
whether any scope conditions which influence the effectiveness of patching within a particular program,
Yeah, so in this case, you know, NREGA, just to give some context, NREGA is a central program, and then there was, and it's implement, and there was a lot of discretion to the states to implement this program. And Andhra was the, you know, had a lot of, was a, I guess the only state for a long period of time to actually implement the, you know, social audit, social audits, which we can get to in a bit, and had, you know, a political support from, what, you know, the then Chief Minister YSR to implement this program well, and appointed well-meaning bureaucrats who were, you know, sincere. I mean, I think there's a lot of like, I mean, I, you know, even when I say it, part of my mind is like, I'm sure people are saying well-meaning bureaucrats, you know, that's like, you know, there's, people are so jaded about giving any agency to, oh, bureaucrats, how can they be like, you know, good? And because it's, you know, so used to seeing bureaucrats kind of, you know, in a not, you know, in a not charitable way. But I saw these bureaucrats were actually, I'm not saying they're saints, they have, you know, there are all sorts of issues with, you know, with the political climate, but I think they were well-meaning. They were thinking about programs, how they want to kind of deliver these programs. They want to, they understood power in a certain way. They, you might disagree with, you know, whether it should be decentralized and centralized, and how this model kind of tries to centralize power, and is that long-term benefits or not. But anyways, there's a precondition where, you know, the people who are patching in this case, if it's a top-down process, you know, the people who are patching largely whose interest has to align. In this case, I think it, you know, and many others have pointed out that it, in this case, it was true. So that's definitely a scope condition and the capacity to kind of implement these programs, right? A lot of them were software, a lot of them not software too, need to have like, you know, to do all this geocaching, to do all these like tech fixes, and actually hire people. And, you know, the administrative cost was, you know, so there's a table I have. I think somebody pointed out the administrative cost was high in Andhra. Is that a bad thing? No, it's a good thing because, you know, they actually invested in all these different things to kind of manage these programs. So of course, yes, there's a lot of administrative costs, and I can interpret that as a negative thing. Overheads, bad, but in this case, overheads for what? Overheads for actually administering this program, having a social audit team, which would go and actually open up these records and give to work, because that needs money to pay all these, auditors, right? So the cost, administrative cost, is definitely something that was incurred by Andhra, paid by the central government, but Andhra kind of used it. Plus, I think the not necessarily for patching per se, but this whole approach, one big precondition, both to get the first mile right and the last mile right, was Dalit mobilization that happened over time, they use the phrase decentralized collective action, Vivek Srinivasan's phrase, which over time they started demanding. In fact, I saw that in the police records, right? They would demand for various things, to access public spaces, to be able to question power, to have, if you have a meeting, and you want to open up records, that, there has to be a certain precondition. And I had a kind of a soft comparison with Bihar, where that was not there, right? And so Andhra benefited from that kind of mobilization, both to get the political will, to get the bureaucrats assigned to do the right thing, how do you think of actually having non-Dalits to work on Dalit lands? I mean, that's a very, like, that doesn't happen overnight. That's not a tech fix. That happens, that's a political fix, right? A political mindset that the ground was fertile. Plus, when you have public meetings, how will you speak up against power? And even the kind of, the strategies they use to use offline channels to kind of question power, all of that have preconditions that need to be met in order for a program like this, a top-down process, to kind of I was going to defend the top-down process. Top-down process doesn't mean it's not democratic. I mean, this is a democratic process, but it is different from just saying leave it to the local, right? And that's kind of comes from the, Ambedkarian vision in some sense. That's the articulation of how they saw local power, and so it's a process to kind of deal with power, but also means that they were not willing to say that, hey, you will, in the village, you will decide your own affairs. We'll have an audit team, we'll have technology come in, we'll monitor it. So it's a very complicated, and many people don't like it because it doesn't appeal to our own like beliefs that people should mind their own affairs, right? Here it's like, who are people sitting in Hyderabad? Who are people sitting, who's activists coming from the outside, looking at government records and opening it up? But I think in an unequal setting, there's something to be said about having outside actors come in.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about next. It's the impact of those technologies. They're used as an instrument by both upper and lower level bureaucrats. Right? So there's jostling and jockeying going on. So you have high level bureaucrats trying to use these digital tools to exert more control, and you have lower level bureaucrats trying to avoid greater digital scrutiny for various reasons. So the act of using and deploying these technologies themselves render their role far greater than initially expected. Right? So it's much more than just a technical fix and a patch, but almost as a weapon that allows power to be exercised in different ways. And you actually capture that quite incisively in chapter three, I think by writing, and I quote here, digital applications embedded in an REGA had politics, right? So in a nutshell, technology is politics and a form of politics that's integral to how public policies and programs are designed and implemented in India.
Yeah, no, I would even go further than, and this might be controversial, to say that one is tech has politics, right? And for that, many people have said this. But what I'm also saying is what is usually seen as technocratic, right? These attention to details, oh, where do you conduct meetings? What should I wear? You know, should you, you know, should people eat meat or not? Should at the as an auditor, should you know, what time of the day that you should conduct meetings? Who should be allowed to speak in the meeting? Where should they sit? These seemingly minutiae technocratic details are very political, meaning it's not something that should be dismissed away as saying, oh, they are just, it's technocratic application. Here, if you really, what I'm actually arguing, and patching is a metaphor in not necessarily software, right? Though it originated from it, to kind of say that these seemingly technocratic things is how, in this case, governance happens, and in fact, so much to say that in situations where power operates in ways that you can't, like, you know, I mean, to quote Gramsci, right? You know, you need a war of, you know, a movement, right, where you have you know, always you can't actually kind of, you know, contest power directly, and you need all these strategies. And this is how, you know, the bureaucrats have ways to, you know, deal with power. So these technocratic things are, shouldn't be, you know, people use it in a very pejorative sense, right? And largely because that's, you know, it's true, right? The, you know, some of it is, you know, solutionism, right? Some of it is because they, you know, this kind of numbing attempts at thinking Aadhaar is going to solve X, Y, Z problem. Here, I think that the Andhra bureaucrats were not techno-determinist. You know, they were quite sophisticated. And of course, they might be, you might find problems, as I do in the book, in terms of specific things that you can argue. But overall, I think dismissing this as technocratic, I think we should just take a pause and see and be able to understand politics and how it affects. And these are the tools, you know, like, you know, Scott talks about weapons of the weak, and here this is the weapons of the powerful. But to use your phrase, weapons in a way to deal with power. I mean, these things are very small and details, but I think I'm arguing not just state alone, right? One implication of it is to also call for attention to civil society activists who are kind of contesting government platforms. And I'm saying, and people are, you know, I think slowly, coming to terms with it, where what kind of things you resist, right? Of course, there's a spectrum of resistance, right? There's sometimes you just have to kind of drop, you know, you can fight the state or whatnot. But some cases you fight with these details. And that is actually very political.
Should I play a round of underrated, overrated? So I'll just throw out a few words and then please tell me how you feel about them. You think they're underrated or they're overrated or they're correctly rated. Chandrababu Naidu.
Chandrababu Naidu. So I guess I have a problem with the answering this question because in binary, but
you can say he's correctly rated or just right.
Yeah, I mean, you say rated. I mean, I think I asked this question before. I'm not sure rated by whom, right? I mean, there was
in your perspective, in your mind, what do you think?
I think overrated.
Other.
Potentially dangerous, but I guess you wanted me to say. No, I can answer it this way. I underrated it initially. And now in the sense that I thought, in the following sense, right? Aadhaar, I thought was, I didn't, and a lot of people are paying attention to it much more than I was. I was like, not concerned overly by it, let me put it this way. But now I feel like my recent trips, I feel like Aadhaar, the mission creep in Aadhaar has gotten to a point where it's not just Malfi in seasons where a lot of people saying, well, this is a conspiracy to kind of go after, you know, become the more security state and whatnot. But even the kind of sheer, difficulty in implementation at the last mile of actually guaranteeing and, without any bad faith, right? It feels like so much overkill for what they're trying to do. And Andhra, I think they should look at Andhra's implementation of technology, where it's really like, you know, much, much more sophisticated, much more pointed and much more iterative rather than having like some kind of universal system that's going to solve all problems. So it's overrated in terms of what it's promises. In significant ways, and it's underrated in terms of how I've thought these, you know, how this would become such a dominant way that it's affecting all welfare programs for now. So I know it's not an yes or no answer that you wanted, but Aadhaar is quite it's not unclear why. It's occupying so much space in our, and I avoided it till the last chapter in this book on tech and governance. How can you not mention Aadhaar? And I kind of had to end it because it's gotten further worse after I wrote that, actually.
The role of AI in development.
Oh, definitely overrated. And though I'm doing more work in that space. But definitely overrated.
Berkeley, California.
Good question. I'm so biased at this. It's overrated in the six, you know, the image of 60s that people have. Oh, all these people are protesting all the time, and like, you know, but it's such a beautiful place that, you know, that I like, but it is definitely overrated in the sense of the radicalness that it seems to exist, that people in their imagination, it's not true.
Finally, smart cities.
Definitely overrated.
Okay, let's get back to the book now. That was fun. So the latter half of the book looks at social audits, right? And which is the accountability mechanism through which bureaucrats elicit the participation of civil society actors to ensure that NREGA is implemented well. So there's this new institution which is created around audits to facilitate that outcome. And you also argue that patching was important here by looking at the institutional fixes. Right?
Yeah.
So, which is led by these upper level bureaucrats who initiate this process alongside activists and other officials. So there's a social space that's created for this particular task. So I'd love to get you to tell us about the audits and how the patching process works here. But I was also struck by a description of activist bureaucrats who you claim are driving these audits. My guess is, in your view, they are activists, right? But are they seen as activists by the other NGO, civil society actors and officials as well? Is that a perception shared by others? Because as you claim, there's a lot of ambiguity here around these audits and where they exist between the state and non-state levels.
Yeah, no. So on the social audit process, right? The social audits were pioneered by MKSS, Mazdoor Kisan Shakti Sangathan in Rajasthan, where they created a kind of public hearing. And of course, this predates the idea of public hearing predates them. But this the recent attempt to kind of mobilize around right to information and the idea of using public records, opening it up, and everyday records. These are not planning documents. These are like how much money at a very granular level, right? In terms of how much money in a particular village is spent and who's getting that money, opening up registers, right? Attendance records and whatnot, right? And then seeing and giving it in front of people. Right. And the big thing difference between a financial audit and a social audit, a financial audit is audits were always done. Right. And even many parts of the world, social audit is actually a very rare idea. Even I don't think it's penetrated beyond the context of India in many ways. And they are trying, I think, to kind of expand it. But the idea is to kind of have people, normal citizens, ordinary workers, inspect government records in a public way. So it's not financial accountants, chartered accountants in Indian context, kind of look at documents and look at the integrity of it. Here, the idea is to take, it's a very simple idea, right? But it's not been done. Where you take public records and go to workers who are beneficiaries of it and ask them questions about, hey, did you actually get paid? Did you get this money? Did work was done in this village? And then do that at multiple levels. One at the household survey, then do it at the village meeting, and then again, do it at the sub-district level. Each stage, how do you, in the patching process here, to add that on, how do you figure out what should be the composition of the audit team? The law said something. There was a design process that went said, oh, it should be done at the local level by these villages themselves. But then, in many states didn't bother to implementing. And Andhra basically said, well, we'll create a machinery around it, create a bureaucracy around it. And how would you, who should do this? Should it be done to the civil society? Should it be done by the bureaucracy? If it's a bureaucracy, then, well, they are the same people who are actually benefiting from it. And so it might be hard to kind of have that independence and autonomy. So, but if you do a civil society, are there NGOs at every village? Answer is no. But then the second important question is, can you trust them? Can it be captured by the local elite? Right. And so you create, and then there's a dance about, again, here's where the resistance comes from, and here the patch, right? Where there was a certain configuration, I go through many, many details of it, or many different versions of it. You had a version where you didn't have the local, reading out of the meetings of the findings, because the local elites would show up and find out who actually testified and go after them to change the record. So they tried to kind of, the patch was to say, let's not read them out. And then another resistance was, no, you are, there was a Rajasthan case which basically said throughout the whole audit process, because the sarpanches got together and said, and the NREGA law says audit has to be done by the villages. Who are these activists from outside, MKS's activists, who are coming in from a different place and doing an audit? And so the Andhra bureaucrats who were, auditors who were, one of them was a former MKS activist, and the MKS, Arun Roy and Nikhil Day, for example, were on the board at that time. And so they knew about this. And so they created a new process where they would have this idea of an auditors who were, they were not called as auditors, they were called district resource persons, and the social auditors were hired at the village level. And similarly, the meetings were, held, and they were in yielding to the pressure from local elites. They said that we would have an ombudsman who would come in and it'll be signed at the village level, and then have another meeting at the mandal level, which is a sub-district, where the local power is less because they're further away from the village, right? So these kind of mechanisms were done. So the institution had to be patched constantly based on realities, right? So again, here, there's no tech involved. This is all institution patching, right? So that's one side of it. What was the second part of your question on?
The activist bureaucrats.
Oh, yes. So I call it the part. So first, I don't, Yeah, maybe I should read this again. I'm not sure I actually, I mean, I did call them participatory bureaucracy and they did use the word activist bureaucrats. But as I point out, these auditors, their positionality was very ambiguous, right? And so in fact, I argued that was, I'm not saying it was intentionally created, but it created an effect which was very interesting because the bureaucrats saw these social auditors as NGOs and civil society people. The social auditors at the local levels wanted to see them as state because they, you know, this is nothing to do with art in NREGA and audits, purely from a personal sense, right? You know, they were complaining to me that like they're not gonna, you know, some of these youth who were part of the social audit team having trouble getting married because they wanted to be seen as gainfully employed by the state, right? And so they wanted to be seen as state employees. They were demanding, you know, both because of this kind of prestige issue, but also, you know, if you're a state job, it's cushy, it's permanent, your benefits, right? So they were demanding permanence, and they were trying to unionize, and I think I talk about it, maybe a footnote where that was quashed by the audit management. They said we want workers to organize and form union, but not the social auditors, right? So again, I mean, it's very complicated and beyond ideology, right? In terms of like how to think about these things. And then the lower level bureaucrats saw these auditors not part of the state because they know they were not part of the state. In fact, they had a much visceral reaction against them because they saw them as not having to kind of get trained in this, you know, if you're a technical assistant at the local, you actually have some kind of an engineering degree or a science degree, you kind of know how civil works work. Here, these people were trained to measure things, but not really, were not engineers, right? And sons and daughters of NREGA workers at the local level, but that even the DRPs were not trained in, you know, in terms of formal, you know, like engineering degrees and whatnot. And so they saw them as, you know, outside actors and not qualified and not part of the bureaucracy. And the workers saw them as outside state actors, right? And sometimes they saw them look at the dresses, and here's where this kind of even attention to detail of that level of how do you position yourself in the village? If I'm dressed up in a nice shirt, you get respect. And if I'm not, you know, you say, oh, these guys can't do anything for us. And then the auditor's management had to kind of figure out, I mean, restrict how, where they eat and what they eat. Should they eat meat, or is it a Brahmin conspiracy to make, you know, so there's all sorts of, you know, conflict. And there's very ambiguity and that I think ambiguity created to kind of very productive attention, which also made it harder to capture that process because it's very hard to, at the local level, you know, the local elite, local capture by elites were not possible because this whole audit team was moving around and it was hard to kind of pin down. And so that actually created a deterrence effect because it was not part of the, you know, kind of bureaucratic machinery that could be easily captured. So I still maintain, I mean, I'm long gone from the field, but last I saw, it was hard to capture them. I'm not saying there was no place there was kind of transgression, but to the extent I saw, there was definitely a kind of an autonomy that was created because of these kind of constant changes in how these things were put together, but also this ambiguity in terms of how they were perceived. And the reason the activist bureaucrats, you know, was to kind of separate them from the bureaucracy. They were still a bureaucrat because they're still writing documents. They were after, you know, they were controlled in a certain way. They had to write, you know, in order to get legitimacy, they had to kind of produce evidence and, you know, in a certain way. And anything that's not written down is not, not considered as evidence. And there's a hierarchy, but there's a difference in terms of, you know, in this case, the top social auditor was a former MKS activist, but it's still a bureaucracy. So I call it the participative bureaucracy, you know, to kind of suggest this tension between them, between those two phrases.
I usually ask a question about fieldwork in most conversations to just understand the practicalities and difficulties of research. So you conducted an ethnographic investigation in Andhra Pradesh and Bihar, largely focused on Andhra. And this involved living and working with laborers, workers, and village residents attending social audits and other meetings. And these are villages, as you write in the book, that are riven with caste differences and political tensions. That's difficult to navigate. And you got yourself in a sticky situation and had to be whisked out in a motorbike. I think you write about it in chapter 4 or 5. And you expand on this in a note at the end of the book, where your identity, your purpose, and motivations were questioned. I mean, it became difficult to be a neutral observer, if at all possible. And looking back now, I mean, how do you assess your position and how people in the field interpreted that position, and whether there was anything different you could have done?
I'm sure I could have done something different, but I had an image, or I guess I had a desire, reading all the ethnographies. I wanted to kind of locate in one place and study these processes as they kind of occur. But that was only one phase, you know, of my project. And I kind of think that it's harder to uncover what I uncovered by locating in a village context, right? Because, for example, this whole text chapter I wrote, the whole, you know, this idea of like, look, and also looking at meetings and traveling through with the auditors across places, and some of it was not ethnographic, some of it was through interviews to kind of trace the genealogy of how these how these institutions were put together, and spending time in with the bureaucrats at the top. And so I had three different, I mean, when I write about it, I wrote three different phases, which is, one was which was chronologically, there was a three different, but also, as you point out, in the hierarchy of the program, it was had to be done. One was with the auditors, where I became an auditor, or tried to be an auditor, like going around villages, exactly what they did, lived in. It's very, very tough conditions they live in, because they live in like these government offices, and they would get treated like, you know, kings just before the audit. As soon as the audit gets, they had to run away, because it becomes, their power just dissipates. They can't even get, like one person said, they can't even get water. So after, because, you know, the lower bureaucrats, because, they, you know, they'd raise all these questions, and they would, you know, they would see a significant shift in how the theater of audit happens, right? You know, sir, madam. And then as soon as the audit finishes, you just get out of there, right? And so anyway, I basically became an auditor, with them, travel around. And the second phase was just interviewing and attending meetings and whatnot at various stages. And the third was, doing a more traditional of trying to live, with in a village in two different contexts, one in a Adivasi set of habitations, and then the other was in the Dalit one, habitation in a large village. And as you know, we all know how segregated these places are, but it's very shocking to see how every single place that was true, largely, right? Like that at least I've been to where these settings were. And I had trouble the third phase, I wanted to kind of get out of any existing kind of support structure that I had, right? Because I didn't want to be tracked by the bureaucrats. And so I kind of went out cold, so to speak, and through some random luck and contacts and I landed in these two contexts, and there I wanted to live in a with the workers, to improve, to understand and get the trust and whatnot. So I did try my hand in working what's called quote unquote unskilled labor. And I very soon realized that it's like I didn't have the skill to do it. It was very, very hard. And both physically, but also kind of actually knowing when, how to break a stone is not trivial. I'm surprised and shocked to see how they're classified as unskilled worker. So anyway, so then as you point out, yeah, I mean, the audit process and the meetings were, maintaining my, identity in terms of like a researcher, as an objective researcher, kind of fell apart to some extent, in some cases where, I took the participant and the participant observations seriously. And so I was slightly opportunistic about like how, what I saw. I kind of gave up on this idea of like, I'm going to be flying the wall. And I really said, okay, I'm there. Things are going to change. People are going to linger at the worksite longer. Certain questions are going to be attacked. And people were fighting about recordings I took and should I give them or not. I didn't. Whatnot. So there's a lot of like tension, and I hopefully try to kind of, be as transparent as I can in these writings, in the book. But it was not because after spending so much time, right, it was very hard to kind of slightly stay away from, all your, I was born an upper-caste Brahmin, and that had repercussions, in terms of where I stayed, and I stayed in the Dalit habitation, and I remember there was a big discussion. Once I found out I was a Brahmin, I think one reddy, a bunch of reddies were, oh, you might have committed some sin in the last birth. That's why you have to go and live. So anyway, so it was quite interesting to see, how I was, given tea once I started living there. The classic trope of, to give the tea and not touch the plate, and so I got a taste of that treatment. And I had a translator companion who's from a different village, right? So he didn't really like play the standard role of, being an informant. He was more like a good partner in with me, and he helped because I spoke Tamil, which was because my strategy was slightly different initially, because I was put to a full-blown comparison in like the northern states, Bihar, Rajasthan, and then like the field work kind of dictated, Andhra kind of came alive, and so I spent time in the border area, Chittur, which spoke Tamil and Telugu, and they picked this companion up from there who was conversant in Tamil, and we would have a lot of fun with Tamil, Telugu, and I picked up Telugu because it's kind of if you test me now, I'll embarrass myself and you, but enough to kind of understand what's going on, and also speak to some extent. So it was a very I think it was a very enjoyable process, but also very painful to see how, when you use the word smart cities, and how far away from that we are in all these caste and rural urban aspirations and whatnot. So, but it was overall, I think there are no regrets. And the question of what could I have done differently? I think one thing that I could have done was, gender is something I could analytically take it more seriously than I did think about it, but it was not something that I could handle it in analytically kind of thinking about it more. I could have done it. And then the second thing is I studied the last mile and the bureaucracies and the attention to the interactions to the last mile. But I didn't really, there's out of the scope of the way I imagined the project in terms of how did these bureaucrats were trained at the top level, where did they come from, where did they get the information from, how are they making money outside at this program, and the kind of, that stuff that, others have written about, I could have done a little bit more of. I didn't, I kind of scoped this program And then, you know, I think more when you write the chapters, right, in the book, you realize, oh man, I wish it'd be nice to actually trace a record down from a master role all the way to the top and back, right? Like the same person over time, and you know, over a span of say multiple audits, what happens? Exact same. That would have been nice. And maybe I would have kept a little bit more data on the meetings I attended, you know, to kind of see how how action was taken or not taken in each meetings. Because I attended like 50 meetings or so. You couldn't tell that from this book, because it's something that it would be nice to have a nice table, which would say, here are the 50 meetings I attended, public meetings. And here is the, actually even more, here are the, you know, exact outcomes. Here are the questions raised, right? I mean, that would have been nice to do. And I didn't, because I didn't know to keep that at that time. And I didn't end that. So yeah, so a lot of regrets, some regrets. But overall, I think the method I am very proud of, actually, in terms of like what, and I learned a lot. And as one of my advisors said, you know, fieldwork is an excuse to, they can take away my theory, they can take away all these other things, but you can't take away the experience of actually being in the field. And she was absolutely right. I think that's something that I still like have it, right, as a memory, an experience that will be hard to, you know, take that away.
What was the hardest part of writing the book?
Well, I mean, I think the book is being written, again, patched, right? to borrow my own metaphor. I had a longest time, I had a very different frame. I called, the dissertation called it democratizing surveillance. And I had a surveillance frame because I guess a friend of mine was saying, I was hanging out a lot with the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard, where I spent a year on with. And so there was a lot of concern about surveillance and records and whatnot. So that kind of got into my head. I think and it took a long time to, because the initial justification was looking at transparency, right? That's how like this idea of opening up records. And I wanted to kind of insert power into this, and thought surveillance kind of gets you free, right? You get it for free, because you know, if I start talk about transparency, there's kind of a feel good effect that you get, and it's hard to see power necessarily easily.
You do interestingly bring up the intro transparently. We should look at it like a flashlight.
The cover actually has the flashlight, you know, and then there's resistance. The sunlight is the idea of like actually having everybody's open, transparency, everything's good. And flashlight is a very powerful relational idea of who's holding it, what is seen, what is not seen, all of that, right? So anyway, so the idea of that letting go of this of that frame to think about development and think about patching took a long time, actually. And not because patching actually was the first thing I wrote, you know, when I came out of the field, but it took me a long time to kind of get that back and connect that thread, because I was kind of stuck with this different frame, which would have been, I think that would have been, you know, would not made anybody happy, because I was trying to, if I was twisting surveillance as a democratizing surveillance, right? It didn't, you know, it is provocative, but I probably would have, you know, it would have been harder to explain. And I think, as a friend of mine said, in India, transparency still gets people killed. You don't need to add power, and people understand it, and the word has meaning. So information politics is actually a real thing, and especially at the at the last mile, where these tensions. So, you know, I said, okay, you know, so then, so that, I think that was the hardest thing, to kind of let go of that frame, and to then reconnect the book with, with this, letting go, and then everything came together. Letting go was the hardest part. I think it was something you're so attached to. And it took me years to kind of shed that. And then focus on this patching metaphor, and I hope it's more productive than the surveillance metaphor Yeah.
And finally, what's next? What are you working on now?
Yeah, one of those overrated things that you've asked. there's a few projects I'm working on, but the current one is, looking at AI, and I think Georgetown, the legal, not the legal, the law center is kind of rightly pointed out that AI as the thing should kind of come up. We should not, should maybe call it machine intelligence or machine something. This idea of artificial intelligence seems to kind of give it more power and more mystique or more magic than it is. But that aside, what I'm doing now is to kind of working with others on projects that that uses AI and marginalized communities, right? And so kind of trying to understand. So one paper that I wrote with Nitya on the project that she led, which was on looking at, we interviewed a bunch of designers, AI designers, who were working on projects in the Global South and for quote-unquote development, and trying to examine how they conceptualize people who are actually providing data, right? Or experts, local experts. And we're basically making the argument that they saw them as data workers as opposed to experts, right? They're like, say, nurses or forest agents or agricultural extension workers, all of them. They essentially imagined them as data workers and then gave them tasks that would essentially take, say, pictures of something over time or do these records n times, and essentially trying to kind of all in service of machine intelligence, trying to kind of capture that like knowledge. In the end, I think everybody loses because the machines would benefit from actually tapping into a much more larger expertise of these local rather than kind of rendering them as data workers. And so we wrote a paper, just submitted or accepted at ACM Chi, we call it de-skilling domain experts, right? And so that's one paper. And then another paper was on, again with others, looking at datafication practices in this was with sanitation workers in Madurai and Bangalore, where we basically are saying, not surprising result, where we're finding based on some interviews with marginalized workers, how these datafication practices, not in development, in general development programs, but just regular workers, how they are, all the institutional biases that exist around society get carried away and become like the imagination of what gets, how AI has been used has all the biases of, what problem they choose to kind of do and how they, how their imagination is kind of translates. So inheriting discrimination is the title of that.
Rajesh, thank you. This is great.
Thank you, Karthik.
And that was Rajesh Veeraraghavan, the author of Patching Development, Information Politics and Social Change in India. I'm Karthik Nachipan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.